Hey everyone, Josh Nason of WrestlingObserver.com here, and if you're hearing this, you're listening to a free show. What a lucky person you are. So why, with all the free content on the internet, would you ever subscribe to a site like WrestlingObserver.com? Well, I'm going to tell you a couple reasons why. You get access to shows like this one every week, and plus multiple editions of shows like Wrestling Observer Radio with Dave Meltzer and Brian Alvarez, as well as a Brian, Vinny, and Craig show, in addition to a ton of niche programming that focuses on Japanese wrestling, classic wrestling, mixed martial arts, and more. Get access to thousands of hours of audios the minute you subscribe. I don't think you could ever listen to the amount of audio that we have currently archived on our site, maybe if you live to be like, you know, 300 years old or something. But that's not all. From your very first day, you also get access to the Wrestling Observer newsletter, something that I call the Wall Street Journal of Professional Wrestling and Mixed Martial Arts, written by the aforementioned Dave Meltzer. You get not 10,000, not 20,000, but 30,000 words every single week on subjects that you want to hear about: pro wrestling and mixed martial arts. You also get access to every edition of Figure Four Weekly, a newsletter founded by Brian Alvarez and headed up by David Bixenspan that takes a different look at the topics in wrestling and MMA every single week. And with all that, you get this for as little as $10.99 if you want to do a single month, or if you want to do a year subscription, you can get as low as $9.99 a month if you subscribe for a full year. Just think of all the things you waste money on every single month. I spend money on all types of stupid stuff, but why not pay for something that you actually will love? Try a subscription at WrestlingObserver.com today. I guarantee you won't go wrong. Welcome, everyone, to episode 11 of Josh Nason's Punch Out. I am Josh Nason, a writer, editor, and podcaster for WrestlingObserver.com. And on this week's show, I welcome Bellator color commentator Jimmy Smith to the program. Jimmy and I talk for nearly an hour on a ton of different topics, including his martial arts background, the awesomeness that was Fight Quest, whether he's been offered to fight in Bellator at any point in time, working with Sean Grandy, the often asked question of whether he should fight or do a jiu-jitsu match with Joe Rogan, Friday's Bellator show, of course, and of course, his views on today's hot MMA issues and all kinds of other stuff as well. But before we get there, let's go to the opening round. And since we talk a lot about MMA media issues on this very show, I wanted to throw another log onto the raging fire of discussion about what the role of MMA media should be in 2015, a topic that I think might just be interesting to those actually in the media themselves, but regardless, let's get into it here for a few minutes. The latest comes from the Fight Network's five-round show, which you can see on YouTube, and I'm actually going to include a clip in the show notes featuring John Ramdeen and Robin Black, who's a really good analyst, a really great analyst. During their show this past week, there was a segment where they were discussing Sam Stout's loss at USC Saskatoon. They took issue with a journalist that apparently had validated his own opinion about Sam Stout's jaw. And the two began a tirade against the media and exactly how they treat fighters like Stout when they get knocked out. Now, I can't do the 15 or so minutes that they spoke on this topic and related topic. I can't do that justice here. But to paraphrase, it's the media's fault for delivering news that focuses on storylines and not technique, and thus they're not playing a role in educating fans as to the nuances of the martial arts so they'll appreciate them more. So being one of the few actually in the industry to have a journalism degree, having covered the sport in some capacity since 2005 and having both trained in Brazilian jiu-jitsu and kickboxing, I feel obligated to at least give my viewpoint on this whole deal, so for just a minute. For this opening round, I was writing up what I thought were distinct buckets that media members should actually fall into, and I was thinking about it. I realized there's so much crossover and so many shades of gray in all forms of sports media that it's very difficult to even do that. Look, I mean, we have investigative journalists like John Nash and Brent Brookhouse, but they both have Twitter accounts where they opine on fights, fighters, etc. There's personalities like Ariel Helwani, who hosts a very popular MMA hour and also works for Fox Sports, which is the primary TV partner for the UFC. However, he can also crank out some really great news stories that are very well written and very informative. Then there's Jeremy Botter. He's a great feature writer, but he can also do straight news if the situation calls for it. There's John Pollock, who works for the Fight Network, another primary partner of the UFC, who he's not afraid to give his opinion either. And then there's Randy and Black of the Fight Network, who have a different mindset, more promotional focus, and more of the MMA super hardcores who watch everything and just can't get enough. And there's a lot of those people out there today. And then there's the ever-expanding sea of everyone else, a mix of insight, truth-seeking, opinion, and for some, thinly veiled fanboyism. But for any of the above, it's really not their job to promote or convince you to watch an event. That's the job of the promotions themselves, the fighters, and guys like Jimmy Smith, who joins me in just a few minutes. The role of the media is to be a medium between the organization and the fan, giving true information and letting the fan decide what they want, not to be a fanboy sitting right beside them. In today's media landscape, that is now more difficult than ever, but we have to have something to strive toward, right? Does the media have a responsibility to be passionate and care about what they're doing? Absolutely. Respectful while being fair and honest? Absolutely. Informed as to what they're talking about? Absolutely. Without bias? Well, that's the idea, but in the case of columnists and honestly many media folks, it's seemingly becoming harder and harder to pull off, especially in MMA, which is still a pretty tightly knit community. But to put blame on the media for fans booing fighters like Neil Magny at the end of a fight because he was sitting behind his jab, that might be the most ridiculous sentiment that I have heard in all of 2015. That's saying something. People that consume media aren't sheep, and there's plenty of technique talk out there that they can find to help round out their knowledge. People are going to like what they like, and they're going to find their way when they're watching any sport. The media can only assure that there's an off-ramp to access that information, but we can't make the consumers actually take the exit. All right, well, this week we have a big MMA event going on Friday night. We have Bellator is returning back to Spike TV, a fun show. As always, a lot of interesting stories on the card, and who better to talk about this than the guy that sits cage side and gets paid to do it. It's something that all of you folks listening to this would love to do. Bellator color commentator and superstar in his own right, Jimmy Smith, joins us this week. And Jimmy, I always try to start with the tough questions. And, you know, I have to ask you, in this world of 500 channels and shows on the internet, and you can watch video anywhere you can and all this, how is Fight Quest not exist as an active show in 2015?
That's the two biggest questions I get asked. I think until maybe last year was, why isn't Fight Quest around anymore? And are they going to do any more Fight Quest? Those are like the two major questions I used to get asked all the time. And what people don't get, I think, is the numbers for Fight Quest when it came out, when it first ran on Discovery Channel, weren't very good. So not a lot of people watched it. It was kind of one of those cult things where it got bigger and it went to different networks and stuff, and people would catch it, you know, on YouTube and all these different, you know, like you said, all these different outlets, and kind of really fell in love with it. But its original run on TV, not a lot of people watched it. So the network didn't have any reason to keep going with it. So that was the basic reason. People forget the original run, it just didn't do very well. So there wasn't any interest in most people that discovered it long after its original incarnation on TV.
Yeah, and that's highly unfortunate, because I'm telling you, man, if that, and I still hold out hope, and this is one of the reasons I was, among many reasons I was excited to talk to you, is that show was so awesome. It was so great, and it's probably one of the reasons you get asked so much about it. And for people that don't know, and maybe we can start a groundswell of you know, everyone does online polls and all this stuff, right? It, basically, Jimmy, and remind me of your co-host name.
Doug Anderson, man. Doug Anderson is his name.
Yeah, so Doug Anderson and Jimmy went around all over the world, and they would train, essentially it was trained for about a week or so, give or take, could be whatever, in different fighting styles. I remember specifically Savat. You guys would go learn, and you would go in these two different camps and learn, and then you would compete, essentially, in the actual end of the episode. And it was just fascinating, because it was a time, you know, when MMA was really kind of starting to come up and people starting to learn that, hey, there's more than just boxing as far as the fighting style, right? And you guys just, you know, very personal. You win these different camps, the culture, all that. And Yeah, I mean, I love the show. So for people who haven't seen it, I'm sure you can find it on YouTube and other spots. But was the show as fun to film as it seems it was fun to film as it was to for the viewers at home?
Yeah, it was, but it was also brutal, man. You know, 5 days of training basically just broke your body down. You know, we did a bunch of stuff, not just with the teams that they would normally do, but stuff that, you know, the producers thought would look good on TV that was brutal, that was really hard. And so you get put through a lot of hazing, a lot of stuff that was tough. So it was fun to film, but it was also really hard with the time constraints we had, you know?
Yeah. What was your favorite place that you went to?
Wow. The favorite episode to film had to be Mexico City. Boxing with Nacho Beristain was awesome. The guys in the camp were great. I lived in Mexico City and actually stayed in an apartment with those guys. And just the camaraderie. And, you know, Mexico City is a great place to train, and it's an amazing place to just see. And so that was, I think, the most fun to do for me.
You hear about Mexico City a lot, and we've heard a lot about it in fight circles because of the altitude and, you know, the recent Fabricio Werdum, Cain Velasquez fight where the altitude is almost a fighter in the cage itself. What, for those that have never been there, just kind of heard of it in passing, I mean, I assume it probably affected you as well. And if so, can you explain kind of what that feeling is like?
It's like you're training in mud is the best way I could think of it. Our first sparring session, we got in there, and, you know, I'm sparring with, you know, Olympians in Mexico, professional guys, really good boxers, and I didn't feel well. I was like, man, you know, I'm just sluggish, you know, I'm just not, my punches weren't snapping. You get done with the end of the round, you feel like you couldn't breathe, and I did the sparring, I did however many rounds it was, I had to spar, and I sat and I'm like, man, and then I turned to one of my teammates, and I go, wait a second, what's the elevation up here? And they said, yeah, 2,700. And I was like, well, that's not that bad, you know, 2,700, you know, that's not killer. I've been worse than that. And then I went, that's meters. You know, in my head, I was like, he thinks in meters. And I was like, wow, we're at, like, Big Bear elevation above that. And you don't think about it. They just train there. They don't think about it that much. But coming from, you know, L.A., which is at sea level, it was rough, man. It was rough training in that. So let alone a 5-round championship mixed martial arts fight, that's rough.
So I've always been interested in your past with martial arts and how you first got involved in it and then how you get involved in it more in kind of a in the Bellator stage of things. I mean, I've known you for obviously the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, obviously a great advocate for that that discipline, and just, you know, we've talked about that. You always talk about rolling with different guys around during telecasts and so on. How did you first get involved in mixed martial arts or martial arts in general, and then in MMA in general?
Well, I was a wrestler in high school, and I wasn't anything special. I was just on the wrestling team when I was in high school, and I was at UCLA, and they don't have a wrestling team. They just have a wrestling club that used to meet up in this room in the Wooden Center. And one day I'm up there wrestling with these guys, just messing around. And a jiu-jitsu coach came in. And he said, hey, I have a jiu-jitsu class in here tonight at 7 o'clock, man. You look like a good wrestler. Why don't you come in here and check it out? And I had no idea what he was talking about. This is 1999, 1998, something like that. So I didn't know what he was talking about. And so I went in there and tried it out, and I just loved it. I just loved it, and I submitted everybody with wrestling moves, and then I took on the instructor, and we went for like 15 minutes, you know, and then he caught me, and I was like, man, I really like this sport. It's a lot of fun. So I started doing it at UCLA, and then got out of UCLA and went to Europe for a few months, and when I came back, I'm going through Huntington Beach, and I saw a sign that said jiu-jitsu, and I just pulled over, and it turned out to be Fabiano Iha Jiu-Jitsu, which became Team Punishment, where Tito Ortiz trained, and Rob McCullough, and all those guys. So I just literally walked in and said, hey, I want to learn. And they said, sign on up and you can learn. So that's how I got started. That was it.
Wow. So obviously you've seen MMA grow in kind of those early stages and, you know, to what it is today, especially that, you know, Team Punishment and all that. You've seen some of these guys. How much has the sport changed and what specifically has changed from maybe training from when you started to today in 2015?
Well, one of the things that's changed is there aren't any secrets anymore. You know, it was more kind of like if you came from a wrestling camp like, you know, Hammer House, and then you came from a jiu-jitsu kind of team like Carlson Gracie, which became Brazilian top team, they all kind of had their little secrets, their little team kind of styles. That's all those training techniques that used to be maybe the realm of a particular group. Mm-hmm. They're everywhere. You know, trainers have just, the sport's gotten too big for anybody to keep anything secret. So the kind of the big teams right now, Black Zillions, American Top Team, AKA, they know every in and out, every weight cutting technique, every ground technique, everything. You know, there are no secrets anymore. It's not like, oh, I really want to work on my grappling, I have to go to this particular team. It doesn't work that way anymore. They might emphasize certain things, but everybody knows everything. Also, guys are gigantic. The weight cutting techniques that kind of used to be the realm of the wrestlers has spread everywhere. When I was fighting, I was a medium-sized welterweight. Today, I'm a big lightweight. You know, guys who used to fight at 170 now are going down to 45. I mean, I saw Diego Sanchez for the first time. He came to the cage when I was fighting, and he was a big 185er. He's fighting at 45 in his next fight. I mean, it's just, guys are just gigantic in the weight class. They're huge, way bigger than they were when I started.
So you fought 2003 through 2006, ended up with a 5-1 record, beat some guys and fought some guys that a few guys that people would be familiar with. What in your last fight was against Jason Chambers, first round submission back in 2006. Why did you decide to get out of the sport in terms of being an active competitor?
Well, it wasn't really a choice in a sense in terms of, well, number one, when I beat Jason, you know, I only fought in local shows, little stuff in California. I think I got paid $1,200 to fight to beat Jason in a main event. And then, you know, a week or two later, Discovery Channel, I did this audition for the show called Fight Quest, and they, you know, and they said, hey, we're going to pay you 10 times that to do a show. And I went, wow, this is a pretty easy decision. And I didn't know how long it would take me away from the sport. We shot Fight Quest for like a year and a half.
Wow.
And they said, whatever you don't get hurt. So they really, I couldn't go back to fighting in between shoots. There wasn't any time. And then I couldn't get hurt and delay the shoot. So I had to take about a year and a half away from the sport. And then I started doing commentary for M1, while I was in Fight Quest. So I just started doing so much TV work and broadcast that I didn't have time to put in the 6 days a week, two trainings a day that you need to be competitive in MMA. I just didn't have the time anymore. My career just went in a different direction.
Hmm. Do you ever think about what if you didn't take the Fight Quest job and decide to stick it out and keep competing?
No, I mean, I'm not one of those guys who, you know, the older I get, the better I was kind of guys. I mean, I was good. You know, I had hard work. I wasn't BJ Penn. I wasn't GSP. I wasn't so phenomenally, ridiculously talented that, you know, oh, if I had just stayed with it, I would have been a world champion. People ask me sometimes, like, you know, where would you have been if you had kept going? Style-wise, I would have been something like a Jim Miller, like a guy who's just well-rounded and a tough guy. You know, a tough dude who's pretty good at everything, who has a lot of heart. I would have been that guy. How far that guy goes, you know, who knows? So I'm really happy with the choices I've made. I'm very successful as a broadcaster. I don't know if I would have been as successful in mixed martial arts. You never know, and you can't go back. So, no, I really don't. I really don't, you know, oh, I could have been a contender. You know, I would have been pretty good, but, you know, you never know how good pretty good is until you get there.
Well, I happen to know a promotion that likes to put on what they're calling tentpole events now, and I am sure they would love to have one day. I'm telling you, I don't know if it's ever been if you've ever been approached with fighting in a Bellator cage. I'm guessing it may have come up at one point, but I would think it would definitely garner some interest just because of how well you're known in MMA circles. Has anyone ever did either Bjorn or I don't even Scott has of you actually fighting in Bellator?
Never. They need me exactly where I am. Yeah, they're like, you're a commentator. You are fantastic. We need you for the show. It has never even been brought up at all, ever.
No. All right. Well, so if somebody listening has Scott Coker's ear, and I know some people on the line might, that might be a good idea for the future. You never know, right?
I am way. They would pay me a lot at 37 years old to put my body through what it takes. And it's so funny. People you hear that every now and then, like, oh, you know, you're still in good shape. Wow. People see me grapple a lot of times through jiu-jitsu and go, man, you're still really good. You should, you know, give it a run and see if you can, you know, get a fight again. And what it takes out of you to be a professional mixed martial artist is phenomenal. It is 6 days a week, training twice a day, plus road work, plus nutrition. I did all that 10 years ago in my physical prime in my mid-20s, and it was tough, you know. So the idea that hey, you can make a run, it's like, you don't understand what that takes out of you. It would take me a year to get back into shape to get into camp. It's that kind of hard. I mean, I'm in good shape for me. For now, I can still grapple. I can still go through kickboxing, still do stuff. I'm in good shape for a regular guy. For a mixed martial artist, it's a whole different level, completely different.
How often do you hear on Twitter that you and Joe Rogan should have a fight, either a MMA fight or a match like Metamoris? How often do you hear that?
Oh, what time is it? Is it like 3 o'clock? I think I've gotten three today. Like, I get it constantly. That it's the number one thing I hear now. When I don't hear about FightQuest, I hear about me and Joe in some capacity. And yeah, all the time, constantly.
Yeah. That's funny. I imagine one of the cool things about your job, and I want to get more into, obviously, you know, kind of the Bellator lifestyle and kind of your, what you do in a day to day basis and week to week basis. But I remember, and the reason it's really stuck in my mind is because you, I think when you were doing a show out in New England, it might have been in Connecticut, and, Kevin Landry, who is a black belt, Henzo Gracie in New Hampshire, someone that I had trained under several years ago. Awesome, amazing black belt, him and Tim Barshard here.
Fantastic, by the way.
Yeah.
He is fantastic. Great black belt, great instructor, great guy. We love him.
Yeah, and you had mentioned that you were rolling with him. And just that, I imagine one of the cool perks of the job is that when you travel, you know, you get to train at some of these different facilities in these different areas that you might not otherwise get a chance to do, especially in jiu-jitsu. And you know, from competing and being in jiu-jitsu for so long, that experience, like one black belt or one brown belt in one school is completely different than it is at another school. And just that experience, that camaraderie, things that you learn, I imagine it must be a pretty fun perk of the job.
Yeah, the cool part is they come to me. You know, a lot of times when somebody's coaching somebody, you know, I'll go into the room and, you know, Kevin Landry was coaching at the time, Rick Hahn.
Yeah.
And I'd walk in and he'd be finished with Rick and be like, hey, Jimmy, you want to roll? And I was like, yeah, sure, you know. So they're coming to me, you know, the coaches and the teammates and usually the fighters themselves. We can't really train that much because they're cutting weight or they're getting ready for a fight.
Yep.
And but their camps, you know, their coaches, their teammates are all standing around just, hey, do you want to roll? And I'm like, yeah, sure, I'd love to. So I've trained with guys like, you know, Shaolin and Daniel Gracie and you know, like you said, Kevin Landry is fantastic. A bunch of guys from the Henzo Gracie team. So it's a great opportunity. You know, whatever Pitbull brother's not fighting, you know, and his brother's there, they'll roll with me, stuff like that. So it's great because I'm at work and they come to me. It's a lot of fun.
That's cool. So you're kind of your daily life, as I said, week to week life. You do, you know, 20 some odd Bellator shows a year. There's no other way to ask this, but what else do you do?
Well, now also I have PBC Boxing, which is another dozen shows this year or 10 or however many it is. So what I do is I train jiu-jitsu at night. I do a lot of that. I write a lot. It's kind of my mental exercise. It's the way I relax. I play chess. I scuba dive. My whole family's scuba divers. I stay busy. I stay busy, man. So I'm always doing something. I'm just kind of an adventurous guy. So I like to travel. So it's just filling up that time in the middle. The hard part is your mind. You know, you're in hotel rooms a lot. I'm always reading. I'm always studying. I'm always watching fights. Especially now that I'm doing boxing, there's 100 years of fights where I've always been a fan, but to really study and look at it through a commentator's eyes, which I have to do now, man, I'm rewatching fights all the time. I'm always studying fighting. So I keep busy. I keep really busy in between fights.
Yeah. So I had boxing actually written down here to chat with you about, cause yeah, you're doing a lot of PBC boxing events. How did that come together? I assume obviously cause of the, you know, the Spike relationship, but, I mean, I assumed you had never called a boxing event before. How did that come together and what kind of challenges did you face in preparing, for that?
Last minute. That's how it all came together.
Awesome.
PBC was coming. No one had talked to me. No one had approached me. As far as I was concerned, I wasn't even on PBC's radar, you know. And then about 10 days, I want to say 2 weeks before the first show, I get a call from my boss, the executive producer of Bellator, and he says, "Hey, Jimmy, how would you feel about doing color commentary for PBC?" And I said, "Well, I'd like to. My number one concern is I was never a professional boxer or even an amateur boxer. I've trained in boxing. I have studied boxing. I've been a boxing fan my whole life. But, you know, I don't have the credibility of a guy who has, you know, won a world title or, you know, was in the Olympics." Yeah. And they went, "Well, you're gonna be next to Antonio Tarver, who's, you know, obviously has a credential. We kind of want you in the middle, you know, as a commentator voice." And I went, "Okay, sure." So we did a rehearsal and then did the first show, and it worked out fantastically well. Boxing fans, boxing writers were really accepting of me, which I did not expect.
Yeah.
So the feedback was really, really positive. And the number one concern taking the gig was, like I said, hey, you know, will boxing fans buy my credentials, mm-hmm. having never professionally boxed? And they did. They just, you know, apparently I said the right things, and they appreciated my commentary and my knowledge, even though I hadn't done it professionally. The second thing I had is I always, you know, you throw out MMA, I know every fighter you could think of. I've been watching it for years and years and years and been studying it for years and years and years. Boxing, I'd always been a fan of, and I watched a lot of boxing. I knew a lot of boxing history, but I had never had the need to study it and make it a part of my, you know, my lexicon in my head. So there's 100 years of backlog at least in boxing. If you want to go back to John L. Sullivan?
Yep.
You have to watch, and when you make it your job to watch boxing, you realize there is a lot of boxing on TV. There is a ton. There are fights that aren't on TV that you got to keep up on. If you watch World Series of Fighting, the UFC and Bellator, you've pretty much got MMA covered.
Yep.
You don't necessarily, you know, if you watch Gladiator Challenge, King of the Cage, that's great too. But, you know, you need to watch basically three organizations to be up on the big names. Boxing doesn't work that way. It's all over the place. So you have to just spend a lot of time studying in order to keep up with the sport. And since I started calling it, that's been the issue. Always watching, always keeping up on the myriad of divisions, the myriad of belts within those divisions. There's a lot to it. It's not like watching football every week, you know?
Yeah. So analytics, or actually not analytics, but like the technique, I think, is in the past few years has really started becoming a bigger part of the MMA conversation. And also, you know, boxing, it's been around for a while. But I think now it's like, you know, fans are trying to get more, trying to understand a little bit more about what they're seeing and look for things and so on. What is something that before, and I'm going to ask you about MMA in a second, but on the boxing end of things, like you're a fan before and then you get into it as an analyst, someone actually paid to do this and try to pick out certain things or look for certain things. For someone that's listening to this, I'll say like myself, who's kind of a layman boxing fan or a casual boxing fan, what's something that I can look for watching a match that I might have not otherwise seen before? Something may have stood out to you as you were watching these as an analyst.
What's in between the punches? What's happening when people aren't throwing? You know, my mom understands when two guys are throwing punches at each other. She gets, I don't have to explain to my mom, they're hitting each other. She gets that. She's not stupid. When a guy's setting somebody up, when they're angling, when they're moving, when they're throwing feints, you know, what is going on inside a guy's head when he's not throwing? Because that's when he's thinking. That's when he's thinking about his next move, his next opportunity, his next trap. Our last fight we did where Antonio Tarver fought, Sean Porter was our guest analyst. I thought he did a fantastic job. And one of the things he said was we had, you know, an orthodox versus a southpaw. He said, "Hey, look at that foot. Look at the way this guy's stepping to set up a straight left hand." And the guy did it. He stepped and set up the straight left hand. But he was looking below the waist, which as a boxing fan, that's not exactly what you're thinking about. But as an analyst, you got to think, just like Sean Porter did, what is he doing that the fans aren't seeing, that isn't punching, that's setting up his offense? And, you know, that's what you have to think. You have to think ahead. Because when nothing's happening, that doesn't mean that nothing's happening inside the minds of the fighters.
Gotcha. Interesting. So on the MMA side, is it similar, or what would you say is a thing for, say, the layman MMA fan or the person that is watching, you know, watching quite a bit but wants to kind of look for something else? Would you say the same thing?
I would say it's the grappling. There's a whole different segment. Like I said, my mom understands two guys punching each other. As soon as they go to the ground, my mom has no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
And it's funny. Whenever anybody asks me about commentary, I always say, "My mom." And they go, "What do you mean?" I go, "The layman. Like the person, my mom doesn't know anything. My mom actually watches fighting. She likes fighting, but she doesn't get it when it goes to the ground. She's never done jiu-jitsu. So that's something I always tell myself. You know, would Joe Blow at the gas station know how to pass half guard? No, he has no idea. He likes fighting, but he doesn't get how to set up a judo throw. He doesn't get an outside single leg, an ankle pick, these takedowns. If you didn't wrestle, you have no idea what the guy's doing.
Yep.
So striking is a little more self-explanatory. MMA, you know, most people have never spent a single second grappling, so they don't know what the guy's setting up. So I find myself having to focus a lot more on the jiu-jitsu side of it, simply because A, you know, that's where I started, and B, that's what most fans don't know the most about. I know a few years ago, I know there was some criticism of Joe from fighters that he favors jiu-jitsu. And what you have to understand as a fan is, and, you know, that's been leveled at me too, is we need to talk more about that. Because, mm-hmm. you know, when two guys are kickboxing, so I don't need to explain he's kicking him in the legs. You know, most fans understand that. I need to talk a lot more about the things that a fan might not understand. So it may seem like we're quote-unquote favoring something, but it's just most fans don't understand how to escape from a triangle. So you need to kind of emphasize that a little bit more. So I think that's partly where that criticism comes from.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think from me having taken jiu-jitsu in the past, and, you know, I was able to watch people, you know, get caught in rear naked chokes before and be like, oh, okay, I think I kind of get that, or how someone sets up an armbar or something like that. But actually, when you get caught in one, and you're just training, you're just rolling, and obviously they're, you know, you're training and rolling with the right people, and most people, they're not going to just look to actually snap your arm or anything like that, but just the littlest bit of pressure, you know this, that little bit of pressure, all of a sudden it just feels like, oh my God, this is the worst pain I've ever felt, but it's just over in a second. And I think it's, you're right, when it comes to jiu-jitsu game and the ground game and submission game, so many people just, they see it, but they may not understand how that feels, because a lot of them, you know, they may have gotten a schoolyard fight, but most people in schoolyard fights aren't pulling out, like, you know, they're looking for a takedown, going to, you know, mount the back and go for a rear naked choke. They'll actually just punch someone. But I think for people that don't understand the subtleties of the ground game or kind of getting used to it, I think that level of education just helps in, like, how people look to escape when a situation that looks like it's unescapable, you know?
Yeah. I mean, if you've never been in it, you can't know. You know, you just can't know. And that's one thing that I think either in boxing or in MMA, you have to translate is, you know, it may just look like a jab, but man, that can ruin your whole day getting jabbed right in the nose. It might not look like a whole lot, but you got to translate. Look, this may seem easy, but that leg kick, he's eating that over and over again. That really hurts after a while. So kind of translating that feeling to the audience is a big part of what I do.
So that's a good transition over to your new broadcast partner, Sean Grandy, someone that we've talked about, talked with on these airwaves before, and had his first show recently, did great sitting alongside you for the first time. But he, you know, when you talked to him, and he had said, you know, I'm relatively new to the sport. He's just been consuming, you know, MMA like a madman, everything that he can take in. And how did you, as a veteran in the booth, how did you help kind of educate him and help him out with that first show and the preparation going into that show?
To be perfectly honest, what I told him is, if you go too far and you're wrong, I have to correct you on air.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not good. I don't want you to seem stupid or that you don't know the sport or whatever like that. If you call a Kimura an Americana, I have to correct you. One goes one way, the other goes the other way.
Yep.
If you say he's going for a submission, you are not wrong. I will tell the audience he's going for a Kimura. If it's in the neck, he's going for a choke. You're not wrong. I will say guillotine. I will say rear naked. I will say arm triangle. I'll say whatever I have to say. If you mix up a double leg and a single leg and an ankle pick, just say takedown. I will fill in the gaps. That was literally the advice I gave him. Is keep it as general as you possibly can. I will fill in the gaps until you get that knowledge. Because when someone's wrong, when they call, you know, when you call an arm triangle a guillotine, I have to say on air, that's not an arm triangle, that's a guillotine. So if they say that's a choke, they're right. I'll go, yeah, he's going for the arm triangle. So my advice was keep it as general as you can until you fill in those gaps of knowledge. Keep it as general as you possibly can. I will fill in the rest. You handle the broadcasting. I'll handle the fight.
Gotcha.
That was exactly the advice I gave him.
Yeah, I mean, I think he did. I think he did great. Considering it was his first time calling an MMA event, I think other than practice runs and everything, you know, clearly, you know, your former broadcast partner, your friend Sean Wheelock, everyone knows him just because he had done so many events and obviously was involved in judging and so involved in that. I think that. I was pretty refreshed. I didn't see too many negative comments or anything like that. I know, MMA fans, as being on Twitter, they're a very opinionated bunch, or at least a certain amount are.
Very true.
Everything is bad until someone proves it's good. And even then, they may not kind of go the full way admitting it's good. They'll grumble about it. But I think Sean did great considering the circumstances that, his announcement kind of came as a surprise to the mainstream world. And, as far as what you're saying, it was kind of an interesting position for you because you were the veteran going into the booth and welcoming this new person in that was responsible for, really a lot of the talking during this broadcast as a play-by-play guy.
Yeah, and the nuts and bolts of his broadcasting, his ability to do the things that we need as a show for him to do, in and out of packages, commercial and back, throwing sponsor tags out there, the nuts and bolts of getting this from A to B, he's extremely good at. And he's been doing it for a long time. So that's what a play-by-play guy really, really has to have a handle on, and he does.
Hmm. Was it weird not seeing the other Sean in there next to you after all that time?
Yeah, and it was also strange because there's a certain cadence you get. Having, a broadcast partner for as long as, Sean Wheelock was the only guy I'd ever worked with in terms of live sports. And I knew when Sean was done talking. I know when Sean's about to talk. I know when he would say the same stuff in and out of certain things all the time. So I knew when Sean was done talking. And then next thing I know, I'm standing next to Sean Grandy, and he's doing his intro. And when we were rehearsing, I was like, man, how do I know when he's finished?
Yeah.
How do I know when he's done? You don't want that stupid pause of like, oh, you're done? I'll talk. You're supposed to kind of know when they're done. It's your turn to speak. So, yeah, that cadence change was weird. It was hard to get used to.
Well, people get to see that for the second time on Friday night. Let's get to the card, because there's a lot of, I was going through this card today, and there's a lot of storylines here, right? And so there's, I'm going to cue some of these up in a minute, but going into Friday night's show, from top to bottom, what do you think is the most interesting story or the most interesting fight or the most interesting aspect? Because I get five on my list. I'm going to put you on the hot seat. What do you think is the most interesting going in Friday night?
Oh, man, that's a tough one. I'm just going to go right into the main event. A lot of questions about Melvin Guillard. He's one of those guys, you look at him, and he's just incredibly physically talented, but hasn't always had the focus, hasn't always had the dedication, hasn't always kept his wits about him in fights. And, will his fighting skill match up to his physical talent? That's what everyone's curious about. And every time there's somebody like Melvin who is coming from the UFC, it's, how does the UFC talent do in Bellator? That's a huge question. And so all eyes are kind of on that fight. Patricky Pitbull versus Syed Awad. 155 really on display tomorrow night. And Syed Awad versus Patricky Pitbull, not only did they kind of get into it, their camps kind of got into it at the fighter check-in. They know the winner's probably next in line for a title shot, if not certainly in the mix. One of the top two. So a lot on the line for that. And both guys are knockout guys. So it's not like you wonder how they're going to fight. They're both going to fight aggressively. So those are the two big storylines to me.
Yeah, all right, let's get into Melvin first. That's definitely one of them. As you said, I think that, a lot of people are wondering what he has left in the tank. He wanted to come to Bellator. This was an opportunity he wanted. His last fight was November 2014. So he's been off for a while. It was against Justin Gaethje. Guillard missed weight, and before that was he had beat Jay-Z Cavalcante, and the UFC stuff you had mentioned. And he comes in here with I don't want to say a clean slate, but he has an opportunity to because he's an interesting name, and we all know that the Scott Coker loves these named guys, right? People are interested in seeing. And these are guys that people are like, I'd love to see what Will Brooks does against him. The just interesting guys. I think that to me is like might be the biggest story coming out of going into tomorrow is does Bellator have a new lightweight contender potentially, depending on, again, how Melvin looks tomorrow night. I think that's because we don't know, right? He's got so many fights on his past. I want to ask you about that, but Yeah, he's a very interesting guy because we don't know what fighter we're going to get in the cage on Friday night.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also, you know, 32-14-2, it's one of those. How much in the tank? When is experience good? And when is it you've had one beating too many? You don't know until you have that fight where you're over the cliff. So, you know, we don't know where he is. Well, like you said, how much you have left in the tank? Huge question.
Yeah. Do you think, having fought in the sport, and granted, you didn't fight as long as, you know, as Melvin has and other guys, and do you think, but you've seen so many guys, do you think there's a point when, you know, when running backs, they talk about in the NFL, you know, certain guys just eventually your legs just go on you, right? The guys just, the top running backs just drop off a cliff. Do you think in MMA, there's a certain amount of fights that all of a sudden it I don't know if you put a number on it, but that all of a sudden the guys, like, they can't compete at that top level anymore. Do you think that's the case?
Completely. And it isn't, to me, it's not a numbers game. It's a beatings game. Yeah, you know, if you look at guys like, you know, Bernard Hopkins, you know, everybody talks about, man, he's, you know, fighting at 50. Emmanuel Stewart said he had never seen Bernard seriously hurt by a punch. That's insane. He had just never taken a hard punch. So there's a reason Randy Couture was able to fight as late as he was, is he was a grappler. He didn't stand there and trade punches with guys his entire career. So it's not a matter of the number of fights, but there is a limited number of beating. There's a limited number of punches. There's a limited number of concussions you can take and have your body respond. And so it's not just a numbers thing. It's a style thing.
What should people know about Melvin's opponent, Brandon Gertz?
Brandon Gertz is a brutal guy. He's one of those guys who's physical, great wrestler, really aggressive, explosive. So he's got the same kind of physicality as Melvin Guillard, but he uses it in a very different way. He uses it more for the ground and pound, more for the takedown. He's got an explosive submission game. But, you know, once again, physically really talented. How he handles the pressure of being the main event, taking on a name like Melvin Guillard, how he handles the internal factors might decide the fight, because he is, once again, extremely physically talented.
Yeah, and if you look over his last four fights, and it's for people that, you know, love fast fights, his last three wins have not gone out of the first round. His last win was a first-round TKO Benny Madrid back in September, 57 seconds. You know, his last loss was in the second round. Two wins before that, looking at two armbar submissions. This guy likes to finish fights quick and not spend a ton of time in there.
Yeah, neither one of them do. So this could be, you know, one of those don't blink kind of fights where we might not get a lot of rounds, we might not get a lot of time, but, you know, it's going to be fun while it lasts.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what we like. Co-main event, Patricky Pitbull versus Syed Awad. It's interesting, you know, being on Twitter, you know, this week, you've kind of heard like a lot of kind of quiet, I mean, quiet buzz is the right word, but you know what? It feels like there's a little bit of a buzz building for this fight. And you mentioned there was a little bit of an altercation at the fighter check-ins. What happened there, and what are you kind of sensing as we go into fight week?
Well, it was Patricio Pitbull, Patricky's brother, and Georgie Karahanian, who is Syed Awad's teammate. They got into it, yelling and screaming, because they were supposed to fight, and then, you know, Georgie Karahanian got hurt, and then there was some words exchange, and they kind of got into it. So it was more the camps. It wasn't as much between Patricky and Syed Awad as it was between, you know, their respective camps going at it. But, you know, Syed Awad told me, he goes, Georgie Karahanian is like my little brother. And, you know, when your little brother gets picked on, you want to defend him. And in defending him, it's about laying out Patricky Pitbull. So, you know, it just adds a little more fuel to a fire that's already raging. Both these guys swing for the fences anyway. I don't think it strategically changes anything, just might add a little bit more motivation.
Yeah, and so, you know, Patricky looking to come back. Last was seen in the cage fighting against Marcin Held. Before that, you know, it snapped a 3-fight win streak. And Syed Awad is, again, he's one of those, you know, tough veterans that I think this is like one of those perfect matchups in that, you know, both guys are kind of at that same level and, again, looking to angle themselves for a lightweight title shot. And, yeah, it should be a really competitive and fun fight.
Yeah, it's going to be great. That's one I'm really looking forward to.
All right, so let me ask you about one of the most interesting stories on the show, and my guess is you probably know where I'm going. He's a heavyweight that is also essentially, I guess, a pygmy in a lot of sense. A lot of great stories coming out this week about the life and times of Justin Wren going against Josh Burns on the main show. What have you got to know about Justin Wren this week? And for people that don't know his story, what would you have to tell him about that if you bumped into him in the street?
Wow. This is a guy who, you know, seemed like he was about to make a fantastic career in mixed martial arts, was on The Ultimate Fighter, and then was faced a lot of drug problems, a lot of substance abuse issues, and wanted a new direction, a new focus on his life, took 5 years away from the sport, and ended up flying to Africa to help out a tribe of pygmies that were basically an oppressed population that were used as slave labor, used as all these things, didn't have a home of their own, didn't have any resources of their own. And, you know, fighting for the forgotten was his whole thing. And that's what that tribe was. And he helped them out. And he is kind of coming back to MMA to use it as a platform to help these people, you know, to buy more land with his win bonuses and help out this group of people. So he's fighting for more than himself. And it's not, let's face it, fighters, you're kind of by necessity somewhat selfish. You're kind of by necessity focused on you and your career and your body and your preparation. And this is guys fighting for more than himself.
Yep.
And that's an amazing story every time.
Yeah. It's one of those stories that you see that just kind of like sticks out and you know, as well as anyone that, you know, when it comes to fighting these days, there's so much content between the UFC, between Bellator and World Series of Fighting, not to mention the, you know, the litany of other shows and all this. You got to have a story to stand out. And some people are like, oh, they don't want it to be the pro wrestling thing. But, you know, Justin Wren's not trying to be a pro wrestler, you know, but he's got a very interesting story that is getting played up this week. So, you know, people that are tuning in, I'm sure there's going to be a video package about his life. I mean, that's, this is the stuff that people get interested in that give me a reason to like, dislike, or be interested in this fight I'm watching. And this is one of the most, I don't say bizarre stories, but it's such a unique story. You never see this. Talk about pygmies in MMA. I mean, that, and just someone kind of fighting for this tribe that people probably have just heard of in passing. It's such an interesting story. And that's kind of one of the refreshing things about it.
Yeah. So the key to fighting is you got to care. And Justin Wren is going to make a lot of people care about him and his cause, and a lot of people are going to be rooting for him.
And so one more fight I want to ask you about, one more person, fighter on the show I want to ask you about, is fighting on the prelims. Someone that we haven't seen since October 2014. She was a name in Strikeforce, former champion there, and just one of these interesting female names that just kind of comes back to the surface every couple of years or so. Marlos Kunin, returning to action in Bellator, so the first time since last year, has kind of fought sparingly over the past couple of years. Marlos Kunin, back in Bellator, what do you make of this?
Well, she's one of the best in the world. So, you know, like you said, hasn't fought with any consistency in the last couple of years. And against Arlene Blanco, that's what she needs, is to find her rhythm and her pacing and everything. And that's not an easy thing to do when you've had time off. So the hardest part, I think, about women's MMA is building compelling divisions. And Marlos Kunin, I think, is the biggest name in women's MMA in Bellator. And it's about building a compelling division around her. That's the tough thing to do. And that's the part that, you know, the issue with the consistency has partly been, hey, you've got to build up contenders to take on someone like Marlos Kunin. That's not an easy thing to do. So she has all the skills, 22-6. She's one of the most experienced in the business. Great submission skills, great finishing instincts, physically strong for the weight class. So she has all the tools necessary. It's about, you know, us as an organization putting on the right fights and putting the right names in front of her.
Anything else on the card? Maybe a dark horse fight that you maybe just like, I think this one's going to be really good that people should check out?
Emiliano Sordi versus AJ Matthews. It's our first fight of the night, first one on the prelims, because we want to make sure we get that in the can, because if it's an exciting fight, it's going to play, you know, during TV. Emiliano Sordi, 13-4. He's from Argentina. Big, physical, strong, young, hungry middleweight. AJ Matthews, 7-3. Fantastic kickboxer. Really great finishing power when he sits down on a punch or a kick. Both these guys are hungry. They both want to make a name at 185. So that's going to be a great one.
So that's Bellator 141. And I got to ask you, we're less than a month away from Bellator 142, September 19th. How excited are you for this show? This is going to be just like a spectacle, like unlike any other spectacle. I can't wait for this show. I can't imagine you must be pretty excited too.
Yeah, none of us can wait for it. It's a huge event for Bellator. Obviously, Tito Ortiz fighting for the belt, his name, you know, arguably the biggest name in the history of MMA, and then take on Liam McGeary, who's the champ. Outstanding, outstanding fighter. I think a lot of people don't understand how good this kid is. And not only that, a one-night tournament with some of the best names in the world at 205. That's, you know, that's incredible. So everybody's looking forward to that. I am curious how it's going to be set up, how it's going to work, how everything's going to be laid out, who's going to win the tournament. I have no idea. I can't wait to see it, and I get paid to be there.
That's great. Yeah. So are you going to call both the MMA and the kickboxing side of it?
The word right now is Glory has their team calling the kickboxing, and Sean and I will call the mixed martial arts part of it.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Very cool. Yeah. But as always, card subject to change, right? Who knows? You could get the call to do both.
You never know, man. Nothing's written in stone.
All right. So you've been really great with your time. A couple more questions for you, more kind of MMA industry questions as we wrap up here. There's a lot of talk these days, as you know, about fight kits, uniforms, all this type of stuff. There's, you know, local, smaller organizations kind of doing some stuff. It's been talked to death in UFC and Reebok and everything. You know, as someone that fought and someone that is paid to be in the business talking about fighters, what is your take on like the ideal situation or what you think about fighter quote unquote uniforms in the cage? What do you think about all this stuff?
I don't like them. I don't like them. It's just, you know, if you look at, you know, for example, if you look at boxing, you know, for the last at least 20 years or so, how a fighter walked in and what they walked in was a big part of their, you know, entrance. It was part of their personality. It was part of their character as a fighter. Interfering with that, I don't like it. It's not a team sport. Individual flavor and individual flair is a big part of why people watch this sport. And to take that away from somebody, I don't agree with it. I don't like it. I don't think it fits the sport. I really don't. You see people's hands raised and they're all wearing the same stuff, you know, in a different color scheme. I don't like it. It takes away a lot of the individuality of combat sports. And one thing about combat sports that makes it so great is your personality and your style can shine. And, you know, Mike Tyson, we all remember him, the black shorts, yep. No socks, you know, no robe on. That's how he walked in. He didn't walk in a uniform. You know, Hector Macho Camacho with the flashy, you know, the flames all over his clothes, however he wanted to walk in. That was part of his personality. That's part of how he fought. And to take that away from somebody, I don't understand it personally.
Okay, I agree. Let's go to drug testing. Obviously, that's a big topic, has been for years. UFC is doing their thing, and now kind of everyone else has to decide what they're doing, if they're going to do their own individual stuff by organization or not. A lot of the questions, will Bellator adopt this? It's kind of been up in the air. Would you like to see Bellator adopt the same style of system the UFC is, or would you like to just see have the commissions handle their business and go from there?
Man, tough for the better. Tough for the better. For me personally, you know, I'd like to see a uniform, really tough policy so that we don't have this stain on the sport anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, guys get caught. The guy like Anderson Silva, you know, arguably the greatest of all time, gets caught, and what happens? It casts a shadow on every single fight he ever had. It's one of those things where even if he was clean for the rest of his fights, you get caught once and it's, you know, how do you know he wasn't doping in this fight or this great performance or this outstanding title defense he had? Maybe he was juiced up. And so, you know, it just casts a shadow on the entire sport. And anything that a promotion can do to make it harder for guys to get away with it, I think it's a good thing. And it helps the sport in the sense of, you know, we don't have to live with that stigma of a guy wins and everybody wonders if he's juicing. You know, if everything we can do to clean it up, and nothing will be 100%. I mean, the cheaters have so far been ahead of the rules. I mean, that's so far been the way it has worked. So I don't expect it to go away. But the more a promotion does, the more promotion can say, we're doing all we can. It isn't us. We're not aiding and abetting this stuff. We're doing everything we can to get rid of it.
What about IVs?
IVs is a tough one because I simply don't know how they're going to enforce that one. I mean, I've heard of tests they're going to do, blood tests to see if there's any kind of, you know, residue from an IV. I get why they're doing it, in that it'll keep fighters from making really reckless weight cuts if they can't IV. The flip side is they might do the same reckless weight cut and just not rehydrate enough. So I certainly see both sides of it. My question is how they're going to enforce it, because they don't have the right to go into your room and look for an ID. You know, that's a little fascist. So I don't know exactly how they would how accurate the tests are to see if someone has rehydrated. But I see why they're doing it. I also see the argument of, you know, if you take away the IVs, guys will still do the cut. They'll still cut just as much. They just won't rehydrate as well, and it'll be more dangerous for them in the end. So I certainly see both sides of it. I really do.
Gotcha. Two more. Fighters union, pro or con?
I'm pro a fighters union. It would be hard to work out. Fighting has always been a top-heavy kind of industry where the guys at the top made a lot of money and the guys in the card have it. I mean, that's for boxing, kickboxing, every combat sport. Professional wrestling, you'll have jobbers that, you know, fight in the undercard and are there just to lose. And, you know, obviously you don't get paid, you know, John Cena kind of money. It doesn't work that way. So I think a union would help a lot. The problem we have in mixed martial arts is that it's a combat sport like boxing, but has a structure that's more like the NFL or Major League Baseball or these big unionized sports. The structure is the UFC or Bellator, these big kind of umbrella promotions that run their stable of fighters. It's built more on that corporate structure, but the pay structure is still more like boxing, where it's kind of every man for himself. So it's weird bringing those things together. I personally am in favor of anything that gets fighters paid more fairly, that gets them paid more money, that gets them more representation and more voice in the sport. I'm for it.
And finally, will we ever see the end of the chatter about a potential quote-unquote mega fight between Ronda Rousey and Floyd Mayweather? I'm personally sick of it. I think everyone else is. Are you sick of this as well?
Oh, I'm so sick of it. I mean, it's stupid. It's really stupid. They compete in different freaking sports. You know, it's just one of those things where look, just continue doing what you do in your particular sport and continue being dominant at it. To me, it's a little bit, and I'm going off a little bit on the side a little bit here. Anytime you compare Ronda Rousey to any male fighter, in a sense, you're disrespecting her. In that when we see, you know, Serena Williams win at tennis, we don't go, could she beat Roger Federer?
Yeah.
We respect her accomplishments as a female athlete competing against other high-level female athletes. You don't see these kind of comparisons in tennis. You don't see these other kind of comparisons in women's sports. You don't see how would they do against their male counterparts. They're not supposed to compete against their male counterparts. They're supposed to compete against other top-level female athletes. And so, in a sense, when people come up with these, you know, what I call these, you know, fantasy football kind of arguments of like, how would she do against a lightweight male? She's not supposed to do that. You're right. Disrespecting her accomplishments against other top female athletes. Nobody says Serena Williams, who's the best in the world, should be able to beat Roger Federer or Rafael Nadal. They don't talk that way because they respect the competition she's taking on as a female against other female athletes. So it's a subtle kind of disrespect to me when you talk about how would she do against a guy, where you're like, well, fuck, she's not supposed to do that. She's a female athlete.
Yeah.
So it's almost disrespectful in that people are talking about all these weird hypothetical matchups rather than talking about the people in front of her that A, she's beaten, and B, she might have to face in the future. There, I'm done. I'll stop ranting.
Well said. Well said.
That's how I feel about
it. So you did mention pro wrestling before. Since it is WrestlingObserver.com, we cover pro wrestling here. Are you a fan, or were you a fan in the past?
I was a huge fan when I was a kid. Huge. I was a huge pro wrestling fan when I was a little kid. I stopped really following it the late 80s, early 90s when I started growing up. And I stopped following in the Attitude Era. I pretty much tuned out completely. But in the early days, in the 80s, man, you could not grow up as a kid, I don't think, and not be a fan of professional wrestling. My all-time favorite. I love Superfly Snuka when he would go off the top of the cage and that high flying kind of style. Ricky Steamboat, that kind of thing. I was really, really into that, real athletic, the Von Erichs, that kind of high-flying style. That's what I loved when I was a kid.
Nice. Well, we're both 37, so you're completely speaking my language here, Jimmy. Good stuff.
Totally. There you go.
All right. So Bellator coming up, obviously, Friday night. Bellator 1-41. Spike TV, Spike.com. You can get the prelims and the main card. Jimmy, before we let you go, chance for you to plug your Twitter, where people can watch you other than Bellator, where they can check in with you, all that good stuff. The floor is yours.
Always Jimmy Smith MMA on Twitter. That's my fans. Keep up with me. Watch me on PBC and Bellator. I'm always on Spike.
And good friends with Stephanie Crooklyn Haynes, a former guest of this very show. I know you guys have a lot of conversations on Twitter, especially on fight nights.
We do. I always keep up with the Crooklyn Challenge. Do the same thing. Follow her, follow me, and see what her challenge is for the next fight. It's always good.
All right, my man. Jimmy Smith, Bellator, 141. Check it out Friday night. Jimmy, thank you so much for joining Josh Nason's Punch Out.
No problem at all. Glad for having me, dude. Thanks a lot.
So big thanks to Jimmy Smith of Bellator MMA for giving us an hour of his time today on a very busy fight week. If you're listening this Friday, obviously check out Bellator on Spike.com and Spike TV tonight. Should be a fun show. It's not one of the tentpole events, but overall the shows in the Scott Coker era have been fun, fun, entertaining, and good. So I think that's probably a pretty good stamp of approval. So check it out tonight if you're looking for some MMA to watch. It's pretty much the only big show going on this weekend. And there's plenty of stories tonight that we talked about, so be able to follow along, enjoy it, and have a fun Friday night. Paul Fontaine of WrestlingObserver.com will have you covered on this very site, so be checking out his coverage. I believe it starts around 8 o'clock tonight or so, give or take. So be sure to check in with that. Okay, few notes before I let you go for the weekend to get out in the sunshine. This is a free show. Please share it, retweet it, tag Jimmy himself, Bellator, all that good stuff. We appreciate the buzz and all the help from when we do these free shows. If this is the first time you're listening to WrestlingObserver.com, you probably know it's a subscriber network. So obviously we have a lot of shows that are behind the subscriber wall, but it's about, you know, $9.99, $10.99 a month, and you'll enjoy it. I guarantee if you're into pro wrestling, especially if you're into MMA, you will absolutely love all the content here at WrestlingObserver.com, newsletters, and all that type of stuff. And I guarantee you'll get the value out of it. So hopefully you enjoy the show and consider subscribing as well. And I guess for next few weeks are being lined up. Should have some good ones, including for next week for UFC 191. So we'll get to that next week. If you're looking for something to check out on Twitter to distract you away from your workday or your life in general, I would suggest checking out Dana White's Twitter feed. He's doing a new hashtag DCOTD. Dana White's, or actually, I messed up that thing completely. Dana White's clip of the day. So I think it's DWCOTD if you're in the hashtag game. It is just quick 15-second clips of just funny, random stuff that's happened in the UFC over the years. And they're just entertaining, fun things. And there's a lot of kind of wackiness and I don't know. I assume this wasn't Dana's idea directly, but I like it. And I think that's he hasn't been out there that much since the whole lawsuit stuff and everything. So any type of Dana White stuff we can get where there's a little bit of levity is good these days. On our site, if you have not checked them out and you're into pro wrestling, check out AJ Styles. He did an interview earlier this week with Dave Meltzer and Brian Alvarez. And also Brian has been doing, and Mike Sempervivi, have been doing interviews all week long with various Shikara wrestlers for their Big King of Trios tournament that's coming up soon. So be sure to check those out as well. And your TV show of the week to check out is aimed towards those people that have a spouse, have a partner, have a girlfriend, have a boyfriend, and they're the type of person that is like, seriously, another MMA show on a Saturday night? Are you kidding me? Can we just get out of the house for once? So here's a show that is very quick. And I guarantee that if you're in a relationship, you will like it. If you're single and just want to go get drunk, just like I used to do back in the day, you probably won't care. But for those of you in relationships and have the band on your hand, check the show out. It's called Catastrophe. It's on Amazon Prime. So if you have Amazon Prime, it's free. If you don't have it, I guarantee you probably have a friend that has it. So just steal their password. 6 shows, 25 minutes each. That's less than 3 hours to get through this whole first season. It's just a fun show. It's about a guy that, a American that goes to London, gets a girl pregnant, and hilarity ensues, as they say, from there. I'm not a big rom-com guy by any means, and I'm a guy's guy like anyone else. This show is actually pretty funny. It's very adult. It's rated MA. Trust me, you guys will like it. It's like anything you see on HBO or Showtime or something like that. So check out Catastrophe. It's on Amazon, and I guarantee your spouse will like it as well, and they'll think it's funny because mine did, and that's a good stamp of approval. So Catastrophe, Amazon Prime, check it out. And as always, let me know what you think. You can follow me on Twitter, JOSHNASON. You can use the hashtag JNPO. If you don't, just tweet at me. That's fine. You can follow Wrestling Observer at WONF4W. And that's about it for the week. So thanks to everyone for listening. Thanks to Jimmy Smith. Thanks to the world. Thanks to the guy that was spraying my house for bugs as I was recording this, and happened to use the bathroom while I was recording. So that's interesting as well. So until next time, insert catchphrase here.